Program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from our studios in Campbell Hall, WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We've got a live show for you today. As I said at the outset of the program, we had an interesting beginning to the show for which we apologize, those fresh air people trying to horn in on our time, but we caught them by the neck and threw them out. And we have a great show for you today. We're probably right now in sort of the midst of a strange dichotomy in American culture, where our news media, as we've chronicled on the show many times, has been very compliant in coverage of this administration, particularly with regard to the war in Iraq, has been documented tremendously now. But at the same time, we're seeing an enormous industry of films and books that are critical of the Bush administration in a way the conventional news media have not been at all. And today we're very privileged to have the author of, I think, one of the most interesting, striking, and compelling of these new works, Mark Crispin Miller, and his new book is called Cruel and Unusual, Bush Cheney's New World Order. It's going to be published by Norton later this summer. I think it's coming out in a couple weeks. And Mark Crispin Miller is a professor of media studies at New York University. His writings on film, culture, politics, and propaganda have appeared widely in newspapers, journals, news magazines, including The New York Times and The Nation. He's written several books, including The Bush Dyslexicon and Boxed In, Seeing Through Movies. His new book, as I said already, is Cruel and Unusual, Bush Cheney's New World Order. Welcome to Media Matters, Mark Miller.
That's great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's an honor to have you. It's a privilege to have you. We've had Mark Miller on the program in the past. It's been one of our most popular shows. Mark, you know, as I said just now, the introduction, there are a lot of books about Bush, Cheney, and films now, too, with Michael Moore and Robert Greenwald, and about the weaknesses and limitations and quite critical of Bush administration and current political situation in the United States. What distinguishes Cruel and Unusual? What's your argument? What are you saying there?
Well, this is going to sound immodest because I think highly of a great many of those books that you've mentioned. I think this is a kind of golden age of political critique, in a sense, and investigative journalism between hardcovers. But I actually believe that my book is the only one that takes adequate account, that takes the true measure of the threat that Bush Cheney represents to American democracy. There are other books, certainly, that note the fascistic potential in this administration. John Dean's book is worse than Watergate, is especially good. But my book is based on the discovery of mine that the administration is not simply impelled by the usual desires that impel imperialistic types. It's not just about oil. It's not just about cronyism a la Halliburton. This is a White House that is at the service of a genuine theocratic movement, and I believe that only this fact can account for their foreign and domestic policies adequately. In other words, Bush's grandiosity. He just said the other day, Bob, that I think that God speaks through me. I couldn't do my job otherwise. He said this in Lancaster. We know about Bush's own megalomania, but what we tend not to know is that he works within the midst of a lot of very like-minded people. The White House is extremely uniform in its thinking. There is no give and take there. There never has been. Its atmosphere is primarily religious, and its aims are ultimately theocratic. And therefore, I regard them as a subversive threat. And the media is basically to blame, you know, for reasons you understand all too well.
Yeah, Mark, let me interrupt for a second and ask you about the term theocracy or theocratic. I think it's a term that isn't widely used in our popular discussions in the United States of politics. And, you know, I think there's a general perception in American popular culture and politics that religion's a good thing, that faith is a good thing. Yet you're making it sound like a theocracy, something connected to theology, is a very bad thing for our politics.
I'm glad you asked me that, because I actually don't have this is no kind of brief against religion per se. I actually don't believe that Bush is much of a Christian, theologically speaking. But let me make the point through a historical example. As you may remember, in Tocqueville's Democracy in America, he has a chapter on the religiosity of Americans. He was quite impressed by the diversity of faiths, by the size of the crowds that would pack churches on Sundays and so on. There was a vibrancy to American religious life that he had never seen in Europe, and he quite pointedly noted that this healthy, what he regarded as healthy cultural expression, was the direct result of the separation of church and state. In those countries where the church was somehow involved in leadership, or, you know, hard to distinguish from the powers that be, or part of the powers that be, church attendance was not noteworthy, and the spirit of worship was kind of pro forma. See, the framers understood that the only way to ensure religious liberty was to separate church and state. That was their motivation. So when I talk about theocracy, I'm talking about a kind of government by religious creed, a kind of state religion. I'm talking specifically about people who would like to see the United States transformed from a constitutional to a Christian republic. This is not a Christian republic. There's even a specific law, our treaty with Tripoli in 1796, signed by George Washington, states explicitly that this is not a Christian republic. In fact, it makes that statement in order to explain why there was nothing wrong with forging treaties with Muslim nations. And this treaty was then expanded and re-ratified, signed again by Jefferson a few years later. A theocracy would be something like Saudi Arabia, you see, or Iran, a kind of government that we're always quite quick to criticize when we see Muslims doing it. But what people don't understand, and this includes a lot of people on the religious right, there is a movement on the right, an eccentric but extremely influential movement, that wants to see the Constitution replaced by the first five books of the Bible, basically. And if you review this president's policies, foreign and domestic, I would go so far as to say every single one of them has been, if not entirely driven by, at least partly rooted in, a theocratic doctrine. See, I hope that my distinction is clear. Theology simply refers to the particular contents of religious creeds, the study of religion. You could be a theology student, you could be a theologian. I'm not talking about that. Those are spiritual and intellectual matters. I'm talking about a theocratic element that would like to see everyone in the country Christian.
Well, and, Mark, let me ask you this. You know, a lot of the advisors to President Bush and figures in the Bush administration, or some of them, if not a lot, are Jewish.
That's right.
Now, how do we reconcile that?
Quite easily. You're referring to the Straussians around Cheney and Rumsfeld. All right, let me speak just for a moment about them. They are mostly Jewish. I don't know if they're practicing Jews or atheists. The fact is, they're not. They're certainly not Christians. But as it happens, Leo Strauss, who was the primary intellectual influence on all these people, and we're talking about Richard Perle, Louis Libby, Douglas Faith, William Kristol's not directly in the White House. Ahmed Shalabi, in fact, is a Straussian. Mm-hmm. Can you think of anybody else so your listeners can...
Wolfowitz?
Wolfowitz, yes, absolutely, Wolfowitz, all those guys. Leo Strauss was quite clear on this point, that it was a great tragedy for human history, in his estimation, when religious government gave way to secular government. Not because of his own piety, because I think he was an atheist, but because he believed that religious governments made for the most compliant and tractable populations. So there is an interesting point of convergence here between all those neocons, you know, clustered in the Defense Department and the Vice President's office on the one hand, and the Christian, Christo-fascist element, I'll call it, that really kind of rules the White House and justice and so on. There's another point of similarity, too, between this particular theocratic doctrine and Straussianism, and it's a bit chilling. I'm referring specifically to a kind of a maverick religious creed called Christian Reconstructionism, which is different from traditional evangelism in that while evangelists tend to expect the second coming imminently, like it's going to happen any minute, the Christian Reconstructionists believe it'll be a while, and that in the meantime, it is the duty of every Christian who considers himself one, everyone who, you know, purports to be a Christian, is obliged to work here and now to establish a Christian republic on earth. This is the brainchild of a figure named R.J. Rush Dooney, who was an extremely prolific maverick theologian who was writing from the 50s until his death in 2001 and has a great deal of influence. You know, I can get into that in a separate answer. At any rate, it's interesting to note that the Christian Reconstructionists believe that lying for the sake of the cause is not a sin. And Rush Dooney goes to great lengths to find biblical justification for this. Well, as it happens, the Straussians, too, believe that there is nothing ignoble or wrong about lying to rule a government basically through a manipulable prince. This is very peculiar across the board because, you know, both movements are essentially rooted in anti-communism, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this charge of immoralism, this charge that they don't believe in telling the truth, was one that the right always leveled at Marxists. But I think that we've got a kind of movement in power now there's nothing they won't do to stay in power.
We're talking to Mark Crispin Miller today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Mark Miller is the author of the new and forthcoming book, Cruel and Unusual, Bush Cheney's New World Order. Mark Miller is a professor of media studies at NYU. He's been a guest in the past on Media Matters. If you'd like to call in, we're doing a live show today. I'm back from my 4 weeks on the road. And the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Urbana, you're on the air with Mark Crispin Miller.
Hi. I wonder if your guest could give us his view of the future of pluralism in this country. I'm going to hang up and listen.
Well, that's a very good question. Your listeners should, and you too, Bob, should check out a website called the Chalcedon Foundation.
How do you spell that?
C-H-A-L-C-E-D-O-N, Chalcedon Foundation. There's also a Chalcedon Institute. The Chalcedon Foundation is basically a propaganda mill for Christian Reconstruction, and it's worth checking out because the people who write the pieces that you can get to through this website are fairly frank, you know, in their intentions and their beliefs. There is one article up there, and I can't remember which person wrote it, but it is a pointed attack on pluralism. It makes the point that pluralism is not a desideratum. It's not a good thing. They don't believe in it. And this is you know, pretty clearly expressed, you know, not only through the intolerant screeds of the, you know, rightist propagandists like Rush Limbaugh and so on, but just last week, you may remember this, President Bush said that he was going to win the South. He was going to beat John Kerry, and he was going to be reelected by people who share his values, which I thought was a remarkable statement for a president to make. Unfortunately, not so remarkable for this president, but it was pretty much of a frank avowal that he is the president of some of the people, and I think he's the president of those people who believe him when he says God speaks through him. I think these are people who believe that they are the elect. Pluralism is something they detest, actually. Now, you know, Rush Dooney, the father of this movement, has an interesting background. He was, on the one hand, an extremely conservative Presbyterian, and on the other hand, he was in the John Birch Society, and often likened the John Birch Society to the early Christian church. I mean, it was a favorable comparison in his eyes. Well, this relates to the general rightist hatred of the United Nations, multiculturalism, you know, contemporary mass culture with its, you know, ethnic mixes and so on. And, you know, we can get into the subject of homosexuality and that sort of thing. I mean, it's a whole separate issue, but pluralism is targeted by this movement. To answer your caller's question, which is not to say that it is doomed to extinction. I'm not suggesting that this movement is all-powerful, but they have made tremendous headway. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
You've all heard of the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, right?
Well, why don't you give a little background on that for those who might not have.
Okay, this is, you know, just how remarkably perverse these people are. On Bush's first Independence Day as president, and this is July 4th, 2001, he paid a visit to the Jefferson Memorial, and then he went to Philadelphia and gave a speech in front of Independence Hall, and it's worth getting the speech. It's on the White House website. It basically implies that the United States is a nation based on the Old Testament. It does this very artfully, you know. And the thrust of the speech is Bush's urging Congress to pass his Office of Faith-Based Initiatives law, that is to say, to create an office in the government that would use taxpayers' money to support religious social service agencies. Now, the argument Bush always makes for this office is that, you know, if a Christian group or a Muslim group or a Jewish group shows a record of success in curing drug addicts, for example, caring for people, why on earth shouldn't they be encouraged? Well, this, you know, makes a certain abstract sense, although it would have given Madison and Jefferson fits if they heard about it. Well, there is now this Office of Faith-Based Initiatives in the White House. There are offices of faith-based initiatives as well in the Departments of Justice, Agriculture, Commerce, Labor, HUD, and Health and Human Services. And what Bush has said, just last week, he said he wants to see an Office of Faith-Based Initiatives in every executive department. Now, as I say, the ostensible purpose of this office is to oversee funding of religious social service agencies. That sounds faintly pluralistic, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Frontline has reported that as of this moment, the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives has not given a nickel to any Jewish or Muslim groups. In other words, it's simply a conduit for funds for Christian groups. I think that gives you some sense of what we're talking about here. You know, Bush, every now and then, tries to strike a posture that's acceptable to rational people. I mean, for example, he mentioned condoms a few weeks ago. Remember this?
Mm-hmm.
He mentioned condoms, I think, for the second time in his public life as a way to, you know, halt the spread of AIDS. Well, that's fine. He can mention condoms. But just like every other of our domestic policies, and foreign for that matter, our AIDS policy is abstinence-based. And not only does it forbid the distribution of condoms, but it actually entails, according to Doug Ireland in The Nation this week, a new regulation from the Centers for Disease Control stipulates that all American health workers operating to try to cure AIDS abroad must say to people, condoms don't work. Now, condoms do work. This is a lie. But condoms are an offense to the kind of religious extremism that's behind this whole movement. So the Centers for Disease Control, Bob, I mean, this should be a disinterested scientific agency. The fact is that science is under assault by this administration. You know, whatever department of the government you're talking about, and many scientists have pointed this out, what people have to understand is that Bush-Cheney represents, as I put it in my book, the anti-Jefferson. See, the book leads up to the discussion. I kind of jumped into the hot part of it when you asked me, you know, how my book stands out.
Yeah,
it builds up to the revelation that, you know, this is what's going on. But its theme throughout is that we have a presidency now. We have an administration that is absolutely antithetical to Jeffersonian tradition.
We're talking to Mark Crispin Miller today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show, so we have phone lines that are open if you want to call in and talk to Mark Miller. The number, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We do have a caller who's waiting patiently. I want to get to in a second. But before I do, I just have a couple other questions for Mark Miller. I'd like to raise Mark Miller as the author of the brand-new book, Cruel and Unusual, Bush-Cheney's New World Order, published by Norton, coming out as we speak.
Just it's actually being shipped to stores now, Bob.
As we speak, it's on its way to stores, so go look for it. And, Mark, you know, a couple of questions that come to mind I think a lot of listeners would be interested in knowing. How do you distinguish the Bush-Cheney administration from Bush 1 and from Reagan, the two Republican and both self-identified conservative predecessors to Bush-Cheney?
Right.
And secondly, a lot of critics on the left go to great lengths to show that you know, there's actually a lot of similarities in economic policies and foreign policies between the Clinton-Gore administration and the Bush-Cheney administration, that there wasn't this huge rupture. How do you respond to them? So both those questions.
Well, you know, you raised excellent points. There is a world of difference, actually, between this Bush administration and Bush Senior's administration. There is less of a difference between this administration and the Reagan administration. In fact, it was the Reagan administration that incorporated a lot of the far-rightists that are now in power, like Cheney, people like that. Economically, I believe that although Reagan made a lot of religious noises, and although it was the 80s that saw the politicization of evangelical groups, you know, I think it was primarily a business-driven administration, and I think Bush Senior's was as well. Now, leftists, I believe, have a tendency to offer a certain kind of rational argument to explain tyrannical powers of all kinds. I think it sometimes is dangerous to leave it at that. This administration is pursuing a set of policies that are remarkable, I think, above all, for their recklessness. We don't find, you know, the ruling class nodding in agreement with what this administration is doing. We find the IMF highly critical of this administration's policies. We have George Soros and, you know, the world's financial elite, the people who meet at Davos, are frightened of this administration's economic irresponsibility. You know, they're just about to raise the debt ceiling, you know, for the federal debt for a third time since Bush was so-called elected. He is, you know, wreaking economic havoc in the government with these tax cuts for the very, very rich, and simultaneously enormous spending on military matters. I mean, that this is reminiscent of Reagan, too. However, Reagan did quietly raise taxes, you know, after a while, because even he understood that, you know, you just couldn't operate in the supply side way without breaking the whole system down. Well, the people around Bush Jr. are more ideological, or I should say more fanatical, than their forebears. They regard government as an evil, a pure evil. They regard any blow against it, that is to say, any blow against that wing of it that you know, provides social services and stuff, they believe that to be a good thing in itself. They also have an apocalyptic turn of mind. Many of them, well, here, let me give you a good example. We tend to think that our Israel policy is driven by those guys we talked about a moment ago, the coterie of Zionists around Cheney and Rumsfeld. I think that's naive. I think that would be the tail wagging the dog. The political muscle for our position on Israel comes from people who call themselves Christian Zionists, and there are 20 million of them in the United States. These are, you know, Christians, evangelicals, and Reconstructionists alike who believe that Israel has a historic role to play when the end comes. There's a ferocity to the Christian Zionism that, you know, animates this administration that is actually far more powerful, and their numbers are far greater than you know, the energy of the neocons. For example, Elliot Abrams, you know, who I believe is also a Straussian, he's the top Middle East expert for the National Security Council, and, you know, he's an old Iran-Contra criminal. He meets on a regular basis. He takes long, regular meetings with an outfit in D.C. called the Apostolic Congress, which calls itself the Christian voice in the nation's capital. A reporter at the Village Voice did a story on this. Naturally, nobody else did. I mean, it seems like an unlikely pairing. And he called the pastor who runs the Apostolic Congress, a guy named Robert Upton. You still with me?
Yeah, I'm here.
And he asked him, why do you call yourselves the Christian voice in the nation's capital and not a Christian voice? And the guy said, well, you know, we wanted someone who spoke for Christianity, and not from the left, not from the right, but spoke for Christian people from a theocratical perspective. And the reporter, this is Rick Perlstein, read the quote back to him and said, you meant to say theological perspective, right? And Upton said, no, theocratical. So Israel, in its, you know, current hyper-aggressive mode, is heavily dependent on the support and backing of the likes of Tom DeLay. This is why Tom DeLay was sent by Bush Cheney to address the Israeli parliament last year. I mean, he seems like an unlikely choice. He has no foreign policy portfolio, but he gave an absolutely fire-breathing speech telling them that, you know, this is a matter of good and evil, that you must never conciliate with the Palestinians. And the reason for this is that they think that the Jews should all collect again in the area that God gave them, and in not only present-day Israel and the occupied territories, but what they call Greater Israel. They should take that all back. They don't. One Reconstructionist said there's no such thing as a Palestinian. And you know, see, this is an example. I mean, this gets us beyond economics, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
This is something that's ultimately mad, and that this madness was not. I don't think it was a feature of any of those three previous administrations. Now, Clinton did, in some ways, grease the skids for this presidency. Clinton's anti-terrorism bill, for example, made John Ashcroft's furtherance of a kind of police state policy that much easier. And in other regards as well, you know, it's true environmentally, too. The Clinton administration pointed the way toward the Bush administration. But the Bush administration has lately shown itself to be uninterested in anything like compromise, in manifesting any kind of even-handedness, moderation. It's peculiar because we have an election coming up. Why, for example, just before an election, would Bush open up the wilderness areas to loggers and road builders? Why, just before an election, would he do that? You know, but that's not a popular move. And this all suggests to me that, and this is the ultimate point of the book, I should say it's the immediate point of the book, and it's also the point of a show I'm doing here in New York, this administration doesn't plan to leave this fall. They don't plan to leave power. That is a notion that just doesn't cross their minds.
You mean they think they're going to win the election?
Well, they think they're going to win it, whatever it takes to win it. You follow me?
Well, be a little more. I think they follow you, but I'm not sure.
Well, they stole it last time. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And this time, they will steal it again. And they have a wider range of means to do so. The touchscreen voting machines are now, I think, in 26 states. They were in 28. Grassroots activists got them decertified in California. And just yesterday it was announced that Ohio is not going to use touchscreen voting machines, which is very good news. But, you know, as long as these machines are in any states, they're made by companies that are owned by right-wing Republicans, and they're completely, you know, unreliable and easily manipulable, these machines. So they're very, very unsafe. We've also been hearing lately, they floated the idea, as you know, of a terrorist incident being used as an excuse to postpone or cancel, as some of them use the word cancel, the election. This is an administration that acts through one thing. They only know one approach to governance, to politics, and that's fear. And inasmuch as they believe themselves entitled to rule, inasmuch as they have contempt for democracy, inasmuch as they are opposed to pluralism and diversity, and believe that they are destined to be in charge. I mean, Bush thinks that God is on his side. God rules through him. They don't see anything wrong with using whatever they need to use to cloud the issue sufficiently to make a case that it's theirs. I predict, actually, that what will happen this fall will be a kind of repeat of what happened last time, by which I mean I don't think it's going to end on Election Day. I think we'll drag on. I think we'll be, you know, truth will be obfuscated. The wrong people will be charged with trying to steal it. It'll be a big, horrible mess, and I have no idea how it's going to turn out. But I'm, you know, this is partly my plea to Democrats, and I'm not one myself. The Democrats have got to wake up and smell the coffee here, you know. This is not your grandfather's Republican Party. It's something very different.
We're talking to Mark Crispin Miller today on Media Matters. It's a live show, and Mark Crispin Miller is the author of the brand-new book just being shipped to stores this weekend, Cruel and Unusual, Bush-Cheney's New World Order, published by Norton Books. We've got a couple of callers who've been very patient. I want to get to them now. Eureka, you're on the air with Mark Crispin Miller.
Oh, thank you. A very interesting program. Two questions, please. Did you hear Senator Byrd's comment this morning about the Bush administration and primarily coming from his new book?
Why don't we get both your questions, caller, and let you hang up because our connection is so bad.
Okay. And secondly, did he see the Jesus factor that was on Frontline, which seemed to reinforce and give evidence for many of the things that he's saying about the Bush experience, about Christianity, and about his almost own divine right for doing whatever he thinks is right? Thank you.
Okay, Bob, I didn't hear any of that.
Okay.
What did he say?
The first thing is a comment by Senator Byrd recently.
About quoting Goering?
I was unclear on that, too. And then the second point was if you'd seen the Jesus factor on Frontline, which he said was similar to what you're arguing.
Yeah.
And that, you referred to that earlier, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I did see that Frontline. It was quite good.
Well, Senator Byrd, though, going back to the first question you made, he has been a really outspoken critic of the Bush administration, probably more than any other member of Congress, or at least the U.S. Senate.
He is proven to be a genuinely great man. And I believe that the caller was referring to a speech he gave a few months ago. It got no coverage, which is remarkable. On the floor of the Senate, Burr gave a speech with the title, The Emperor's New Clothes. And in it, he quotes the famous remark that Hermann Göring made to the prison psychiatrist at Nuremberg when Göring was incarcerated there. They were talking about how you rule successfully, how you pull things off, such as the Nazis pulled off. And he said, with a certain weary cynicism, Göring did, it doesn't really matter what kind of government you have. It can be a democracy or a dictatorship. All you really need to do is to convince the people that they're under attack, that anyone who disagrees is a traitor, and you can do anything you want. That was quoted. I mean, the fact that Göring was quoted on the floor of the United States Senate in a speech used to characterize the approach of the party in power, I think is remarkable. And it's quite a remarkable speech. Got no coverage. Other strong statements by certain other Democrats have also been ignored.
Well, let's talk, Mark, if we can, about the media coverage of the Bush administration. I know that's a theme that in the book and one that you've been studying for years.
Right.
I mean, you write a lot about it in the book. You talk a lot about the propagandists of the political right, the Limbaughs and Hannitys. Well, let's just start with the propagandists of the political right. Let's work there first.
Okay.
What about them?
Just talk about them.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's your argument in the book concerning the role that Limbaugh, Hannity, Drudge, Bennett, and Coulter play?
Yeah, well, they function. Well, first of all, you know, I've learned a lot of this stuff from you, Bob. Am I going to be shy about it? You've been a great influence on me. You know, when the right set out to seize the culture, to take it back after the '60s. You know, media was uppermost in their minds, and one of the things they did was to deregulate media in 1987 in such a way that it would be possible to dominate the airwaves with just one point of view. So we now have a whole range, a whole choir of propagandists speaking on behalf of Bush Cheney. What strikes me as remarkable about all of them is that, without exception, they appeal to hatred. And I argue in the book that their arguments are always projective arguments and that the movement we're dealing with is a projective movement. Now, this is what I mean by that.
Okay.
Projectivity is the tendency to impute to others and to attack others for the very qualities or desires that you most hate in yourself. So, for example, when the Republicans say that the Democrats are a coalition of the wild-eyed, when the Republicans accuse the Democrats of acting like Hitler, when Tom DeLay accuses Ted Kennedy of what he calls hate speech, this was Kennedy, you know, criticized the war policy in Iraq, these are all classic cases of projection. They're always talking about themselves. And you know, I think it is at once... It is, you know, one and the same time, an extremely crafty and basic propaganda tactic to accuse your enemy of what you're going to do, or you know, thinking the way you really think. But at the same time, I believe it's also a symptom of a paranoid way of apprehending the world. So you listen to a guy like Sean Hannity, or you listen to Rush Limbaugh. They're constantly accusing the left of trying to silence the right. Accusing the left of being, you know, narrow-minded, bigoted, etc. All of it is self-reflexive. And, you know, this goes all the way to the top, because whenever Bush talks about Saddam Hussein, he's really talking about himself. You know, I go into this in detail in the book. At any rate, the chorus of propaganda that we get inescapably from our media today because of their inordinate, you know, presence in the media system is ultimately pathological, you know? I mean, I know you've done some right-wing shows. I was on O'Reilly's show. I've seen people try to talk to Sean Hannity. You know, we're dealing with a mindset here that is not interested in discussion or argument in any sense is only interested in venting. You know, the Rush Limbaugh, for example, one of his favorite laugh lines when he addresses the faithful in person is, leave some liberals alive. He likes to say that. It gets a big laugh. Leave some liberals alive. And he goes on to say, because we want the children of tomorrow to see, you know, what kind of creatures real Americans like us had to put up with. Well, that's not the reason why he says it. I mean, I think he really means it. But I think the reason why he says leave some liberals alive is that there would be no movement now. There would be no rightist movement now if they did not have objects of their projective hatred. In other words, you take away targets for their projective hatred, there's no movement. Because what this movement is projectivity. And, you know, at the kind of national or geopolitical level, you've got a Christo-fascist movement that is convinced that it is under threat. Christians of this kind that I'm talking about, these Christian fanatics, actually believe that Christians are persecuted in the United States. Rush Limbaugh's brother David has a book out called Persecution. It has a lion on the cover, and its argument is that Christians are persecuted in the United States. Well, Bush is quoted in a recent book about his family, actually a pro-Bush book, to the effect that this war, that Bush, this is from a close family member, I misspeak, Bush didn't say it, a close relative said it, George sees this as a religious war. He believes that they are trying to kill the Christians and that the Christians must strike back with more force and more ferocity than they will ever know. Now, that's a perfectly projective statement. They're full of hostility toward us. They want to wipe us out. Therefore, we have to kill them all. This is no different psychologically from the worldview of Osama bin Laden, who believes that the Jews and Christians are trying to wipe out Islam, and they are acting only in self-defense. And I think it's a kind of, it's a kind of malignant projection that you find in hate movements of all kinds, you know, Nazism, whatever, you name it. Even Hitler believed, this seems hard to take, but it's true, that his last words were a reference to the continuing danger posed by world Jewry. You know, he thought he was fighting back against a superior power.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of gets right at the heart of the peculiar venomousness and irrationality of people like Michael Savage, who condemns the Weimar Republic for its decadence. I'm not kidding. Compares Clinton to the Weimar Republic, complains about the decadence of liberal democracy. He sounds like Hitler. But he's Jewish. His real name is Mike Weiner. You know, I mean, this is just an example of the kind of projective stuff that I'm talking about. People who, well, they must have someone else to attack for doing what it is they themselves want to do, or for being what it is they don't want to be. Mm-hmm. And you know, the propagandists fill the airwaves with this kind of sort of demented chatter.
But, you know, these are not the anchors on our cable news networks, at least on a couple of them, or on our network news, or the editors of our daily newspapers. How does the balance of the news media, or the mainstream conventional news media, balance this sort of
balance?
Stand up? Does it? How good of a job does it do to counter this?
It has done an excellent job at allowing all this to happen. It's done a superb job of facilitating everything I'm talking about. The mainstream media in this country is utterly complicit, you know, half consciously, I suppose, in the gradual devastation of American democracy. We're seeing this now. I have a whole chapter in the book, in Cruel and Unusual, about Scott Ritter. Remember him?
Sure.
Scott Ritter, a Marine, a Republican. This is the guy who went over to Baghdad, last fall, or the fall before the war, I should say, and spoke to the General Assembly, the Baathist General Assembly, trying to get them to come around and let weapons inspectors in and just be as straightforward as they possibly could be, that they had nothing left, you know, as opposed to the bluff that Saddam Hussein was keeping up. Well, you know, he knew more about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq than practically anybody alive. You know, he'd been a weapons inspector there for years. He really knew his stuff. I have a chapter on the way he was treated by the media in this country when he tried to make this point, which he was trying to make for the good of the American people. I have extensive transcripts of what happened to him on CNN, on Fox, and I also have plenty of examples from the New York Times and the Washington Post. This guy was treated like a pariah. He was treated like a traitor. And it turns out that every single thing he said was true. And not only did they treat him as a traitor and a flake, you know, and a lunatic, but they would bring on other people who were there to give us the truth, you know, the solid view, the anti-Ritter view.
Mm-hmm.
These were people like James Woolsey and, you know, Max Boot and all these other neocons who would come on and say things like, you know, the Iraqis will welcome us with open arms and so on. Everything they said has turned out to be disastrously false, but they were the ones who were explicitly favored by the people on camera and by the writers. I mean, I think it's a useful exercise to go back and get all this stuff because we can see how badly our media has failed to honor its First Amendment obligations to tell us what's happening. Our media is just pathetic. I don't know how many of your listeners know, for example, that Dick Cheney was recently indicted on criminal charges in France for stuff he did as CEO of Halliburton. Did you know this?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. You know where it was reported? It was reported in Le Monde. It was reported in France. It was reported all over France. Somebody sent me the piece from Le Monde, Alice Cherbonnier from the Baltimore Chronicle. This story hasn't been reported anywhere. And I think it's rather an important story, don't you?
I would say so.
Yeah, well, that's just typical, you know. And, you know, I'm with you on this issue, Bob. The media system that we have now is worse than useless. It has to be reformed from the ground up because they're not serving us. They're serving the White House and their advertisers. Oh, the last straw, the thing that I think most clearly demonstrates their traitorousness. I'm not going to, you know, put a fine point on it. When Tom Ridge floated the idea of canceling the election because of a terrorist attack, this suggestion was treated as a reasonable one by the press. In fact, the whole thing was treated as a partisan issue. So you had Republicans saying, yeah, we should cancel the election if necessary. You had Democrats saying, no, we shouldn't. And we have the press, you know, as ever, pretending to be even-handed, expressing no surprise, in no sense conveying the notion that this would be not just unprecedented, but a grotesque betrayal of the Constitution. Some very powerful quotes from Abraham Lincoln. In 1864, when there was a civil war going on, many people asked him to postpone that presidential election, and he made an unambiguous statement. We're not a free country if we don't have elections, and if we put them off or if we cancel them, he said at the time, this rebellion will already have conquered us. Well, that, you know, that the people whom the First Amendment obligates to tell us the truth about what's happening, the people whom the First Amendment has, you know, basically deputized to keep us politically informed, treat this enormous, this egregious suggestion, possibility of actually canceling an election, as if it were something to take seriously and mull over, you know.
Mark, we've got one caller, and we've only got a few minutes left, so let's get back to the phone lines and take this last caller.
Okay.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Mark Crispin Miller, the author of the brand-new book, Cruel and Unusual, Bush-Cheney's New World Order. We've been talking about it for the last 45 minutes. And let's go to the phone lines. Line 4, Crystal Lake, you're on the air with Mark Crispin Miller.
I agree with you, Speaker, and I do think that that Bush does give money to the Christian Right Foundation so that they can get richer and vote for him, of course. But, you know, even also I think fear is so important because, like, Reverend Jerry Falwell, he used fear to a degree to say that, well, if you don't contribute to me, there's going to be some disaster to our movement or something like that. And I do think, though, that while the theocracies claim to be so devout, they seem more violent than some than a lot of religions. I know we all go to war, but you know they bash the gays and they are so against doctors, you know, and pro-choice things. And I do think that we have to, you know, we have to stop some of their work, their things that they're doing. And actually, the groups that are more religiously minded, you might say, caring about people are like the ACLU. There's a lot of Jews in there, and I think I'm grateful that there are. But they defend any group, and they're even better, I think, than some religions. So, you know, no religion really knows enough to preach against war, although it should be our tenet. It isn't, but the Christian right pretends to be so devout. Now you take Reverend David Beckwith. I think he's even an evangelical in the Sojourners. His value is eliminating poverty. And I think that's a better goal than just worrying about a few people that can't afford to have children.
Caller, I want to thank you very much for calling in and making your comments. We only have a minute left, so I'm going to go back to Mark Miller if I can. Mark, you know, we've only got about a little over a minute left. I mean, clearly you see us at a crucial juncture.
Totally.
In this country's history, I gather from listening to you and reading your work, I mean, this ranks as, you know, with the Civil War and one or two other periods as sort of a defining moment in the course of this country's history. And given the role this country plays in the world and the history of our species, not to be too grandiose, you know, what should people do? People who share your concerns, what should they be doing in the next few
months? You know, there's no silver bullet. The framers didn't have a solution to their problem. They were going up against the most powerful military empire in the world, and they knew they could end up being executed if they lost. I think that they were strengthened by precisely that commitment and by that fear. I think that too many Democrats are complacent about what's happening, or, let's put it this way, simply uninformed, and that's not necessarily their fault. What people have to do is face. This is a mental thing, okay? Whatever they do, whatever the money they give to groups they join, they have to be active. But they have to make this mental adjustment. They have to realize that we're dealing with an alien movement here. We have to realize we're dealing with a subversive movement that intends to stay in power regardless of anything that the electorate may want. If you think of them that way, if you know, you won't be shocked into paralysis by the outrageous things they do, and you just may well be strengthened to take whatever constitutional action is necessary.
Mark Christopher Miller, on that note, I'm afraid I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means I got to clear out of the studio. I want to thank Mark Christopher Miller for being my guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Mark Miller is the author of the brand-new book, Cruel and Unusual, Bush Cheney's New World Order. Please come back a week from today, and I'll have Susan Lynn on the air talking about the commercialization of childhood. For the next 167 hours, take care of yourself, and I'll see you in a week. Bye-bye.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Sugar Creek Symphony and Song, an opera and classical music festival in Watseka, Illinois, from August 6th through 8th, featuring violinist Nicholas DiEugenio with folk songs for the violin. More info at sugarcreekfestival.org.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a high around 79 degrees and north winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low in the upper 50s and north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour and diminishing. Tomorrow, mostly sunny in the morning, then becoming partly sunny, the high in the mid-80s with west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at WILL.UIUC.edu. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.